presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Happy 4th of July. Happy birthday, America, as Lauren was just saying to me, Lauren Kirshner. It is the 4th of July. It's a beautiful day. And we're broadcasting from high atop 30 feet of water in a river in Portland. We'll tell you about that a little bit later. It's our quote for the day from one of the founders of this country, George Washington, who said, "As mankind becomes more liberal, they will be more apt to allow all those who conduct themselves as worthy members of the community are equally entitled to the protections of civil government. I hope ever to see America among the foremost nations of justice and liberality." President George Washington, the first president of the United States here on this 4th of July. We also, on the 4th of July, are celebrating a process that began in November of 1773. It began when the good citizens of Boston stood up and said, "Multinational corporations running this country is something we will no longer tolerate." And they overthrew the British East India Company in Boston Harbor. It was the first revolt against a multinational corporation. Well, the East India Company was the first truly transnational or global corporation in a big way in the history of the world. Prior to that, you had the Dutch trading companies as well. But this was the biggie. And their interests were being defended by the British Army in the United States, and the U.S. citizens overthrew them. We will be talking about that as we go on through the day. So today, the day that we celebrate the creation of civil society, civil government, to quote George Washington, to replace the power and rule of absolutely unrestrained, untrammeled, well, capitalism, I guess you'd call it, although it really was cronyism. Sandy Bourne is with us. Sandy is the Vice President for Policy and Strategic Development at the Heartland Institute, heartland.org, and IWF, also I had the website up here a little earlier, Sandy. It's the International Women's...
The Independent Women's Forum.
Independent Women's Forum, right. And in fact, I notice your web memo number one is about what a shame it is that the Baucus-Grassley tax increase would raise the tax on people who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, raise their tax from 15% to what the rest of us pay.
Well, we're opposed to any kind of tax increase at all. We really feel that is just harmful to the economy.
Well, this is the thing that boggles my mind. I spent some time over at Heartland. I've seen the sites that list your donors. It's a conservative organization. The donors list is a who's who. You know, the Scaifes and the Coors and whatnot. The Walton family, and you're right now as we speak. I noticed over at Heartland Institute, you're running a program for people who are elected officials to come to Massachusetts. In fact, you'll even pay for their airfare to learn from you about energy policy, and you're concerned about, you know, biofuels and all this, and you make this statement in your press release. IWF researcher Sandy Bourne will explain why bureaucratic mandates can never solve our energy problems. Victory in the fight for energy independence must come from the free market if the government doesn't mess it up. On this 4th of July, how could anybody be crazy enough to say that the profit motive is the main definer of the public good in the United States?
Well, happy Independence Day to you, number one.
Thank you.
Number two, one of the great things that our founding fathers gave to us under the rule of law was and with property rights were free markets. And it was their concept that we would be able to have free trade and have markets, both local, statewide, domestic, international markets, provide for free trade and ultimately individual freedom over time. Now, when you were describing the Heartland Institute, what you didn't say, which is also up on our website, is that we receive less than 4% of our revenues from corporations. We get the bulk of our funds from foundations and individual contributions. And we are hosting an energy summit up in Rhode Island in August to teach state legislators about how our energy markets work. And the concern, particularly under climate change and under the latest Energy Policy Act that was passed by Congress, is that there have been mandates put across the country that we feel are beginning to be not only economy, but also to the environment. And for example, ethanol is a classic example of that. Several states have imposed to be used for gasoline or in addition to gasoline consumption. And that has hurt the food markets. That is winding up taking a lot of land that we had put into conservation out of conservation, because the farmers are seeing that they can make more money growing corn to meet the ethanol.
Right. So your basic argument is that any time government intervenes in the marketplace, it distorts the marketplace and screws things up.
There you have it.
In a nutshell. You started out by saying one of the things that the founders gave us was the free market. I would submit to you that the founders not only did not give us a free market, but that the founders very clearly were intending to create a country that could intervene in the market. You will find in the Constitution no mention of the free market. In fact, instead, you will find in the Constitution that the explicit power of government, this is what the founders put together, was to regulate commerce between the various states. That the word corporation does not exist in the Constitution. And if you go back and read the Federalist Papers, you'll discover that the reason why it doesn't was because they wanted corporations to be controlled at the state level so that, to quote Alexander Hamilton, a conservative, their mischief could be controlled. I mean,
the founders very much did not believe in a free market. They believed in a regulated federal market. Yeah, they did not want to have a national government controlling commerce. They did want it controlled better. They thought it was better at the state level. You're absolutely right about that.
No, they wanted a federal government that could regulate commerce that was larger than at the state level. Commerce between the states is the phrase from the Constitution.
Right, to ensure
And my point is that there is no such thing as a free market. The market came into being as a consequence of the government creating it. We, the people, created the laws that allow corporations like the one that owns this radio program, my corporation, or your nonprofit corporation. Government created the laws that allow these things to exist. Government created the laws that allow ExxonMobil and ADM, the people that you would like to turn our energy policy over to exist, and government has the right to regulate those things.
When you say ADM, you mean Archer?
Archer Daniels Midland,
yeah,
sure. They're one of the big companies that's moving into biofuels.
Yeah, we're opposed to the subsidies that are going out there for ethanol. I think you and I are in agreement on that.
My point is not that, you know, a particular policy. I mean, you know, we can get into that if you want. But the larger issue here that you're saying that we should simply, turn the fate of this country. It's like, why would anybody hate America so much that they would want to turn our future over to the robber barons?
I think you're misinterpreting what I just said. We are opposed to government subsidies to corporations of any kind. We think that that's wrong.
But the creation of a corporation is a government subsidy.
We do not support ethanol subsidies. We do not support.
No, I understand. I understand that. Because in your mind, that's government interference in the marketplace. But why do you think that ExxonMobil and Archer's Daniel Midland will do a better job defining our energy policy than we, the people, and our elected representatives?
I say that the marketplace will do a better job. I think that oftentimes consumers will demand energy efficiency, they demand affordability, and they demand reliability in the products that they choose to consume. And so the market will force any product provider, if you go, or corporation to provide those kinds of products, or they simply will not consume it.
But the simple fact of the matter is the consumers don't confront the externalities. The so-called market that you're talking about isn't looking at the cost, the real cost of, for example, the cancers caused by the use of fossil fuels.
The real cost.
When people decide to buy a car versus buying an electric car, they're not saying, you know, I think I'll buy this car because it's going to cause fewer cancers, and one of them might be me.
They're purchasing a vehicle for one, for transportation. Two, is it a vehicle that's safe? Three, is it a vehicle that is efficient? And four, is it a vehicle that's affordable? an electric car is very expensive right now. If we can increase the supply of electric cars and they're reliable.
Well, and how we do that is where you and I part company. But we'll have to wrap it at that. People can go to heartland.org or IWF.org for more information. Sandy Bourne, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Happy 4th of July! Happy birthday, America. You know, it all started in the fall of 1773. Prior to this, even Thomas Jefferson had opposed independence from Great Britain. He'd written it was about a 30, 40-page booklet, about how basically to be a good citizen in British America. But it was the events of fall of 1773 that changed his mind and changed the minds of many Americans. When the British East India Company, and by the way, we are live today here on the 4th of July, broadcasting live, and we will be taking your calls as we go throughout the day, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com or airamerica.com, and click on the Tom Hartman page, and there's a link right there to our live chat room, also to our blog, which we'll be reading today. But in the fall of 1773, the British East India Company tried to pull a Walmart. They tried to pull an ExxonMobil. They tried to pull a, you know, whatever, you know, fill in the blank. They got a huge tax break. It's called the Tea Act of 1773. You know, this whole no taxation without representation thing that the colonists were all yelling about. What they were talking about was the fact that one corporation, the East India Company, one huge, giant, global corporation, got a tax cut that was so huge that it threatened to put out of business all the small entrepreneurs who were bringing tea to the United States. I have a copy, of the only book that was ever written that was a first-hand account of the Boston Tea Party. And it's quite extraordinary. I bought it when I was writing What Would Jefferson Do? And in fact, it was published in 1834 as George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, who wrote it, was in his 80s then, as I recall, and an old man in upstate New York. And he had, like all of the people who participated in the Tea Party, he had sworn, 50 years of silence about who was involved, because these guys were all committing a crime. A major crime. I mean, the penalty of death for privateering could have been applied to them, arguably. And so, anyhow, George Robert Twelvetree Hughes writes about this, and he talks about the Tea Act of 1773, which cut the taxes on the East India Company. His book is called A Retrospect of the Boston Tea Party, with a memoir of George R.T. Hughes, a survivor of the little band of patriots who drowned the tea in Boston Harbor in 1773. He, by the way, once had dinner with George Washington. He writes in the book, he says, Martha Washington waited upon us at table at dinner time and was remarkably social. It's amazing. So our quote from George Washington opened the day. So in the fall of 1773, Rusticus, George Hughes writes about this. This was the flyer that appeared all over Boston, all over Philadelphia in the fall of 1773 when they learned that the British government had given a tax break to this huge corporation, this transnational global corporation, and it was going to wipe out the small entrepreneurs who were importing their own tea into the United States, or what was then, British America. It was called The Alarm. It was written by Rusticus. He says, are we in like manner to be given up to the disposal of the East India Company, who now have the assurance to step forth in aid of the minister to execute his plan of enslaving America? Now, they're talking here of economic enslavement, handing this country over to the robber barons of that day. Back to the flyer. Their conduct in Asia for some years past, he's talking about the East India Company, has given simple proof how little they regard the laws of nations, the rights, liberties, or lives of men. They have levied war, excited rebellions, dethroned lawful princes, and sacrificed millions for the sake of profit. See, the no taxation without representation was how dare they give a corporation a tax cut without her having a say in it. Back to the flyer. And these not being sufficient to glut their avarice, they have by the most unparalleled barbarities, extortions, and monopolies, there's that word that we don't use anymore, stripped the miserable inhabitants of their property and reduced whole provinces to indigence and ruin. 1,500,000, it is said, perished by famine in 1 year, not because the earth denied its fruits, but because this corporation and their servants engulfed all the necessities of life and set them at so high a price that the poor could not purchase them. Rusticus added in May 27, 1773, another pamphlet, resolve thereby, nobly resolve, and publish to the world your resolution that no man will receive the tea, no man will let his stores or suffer the vessel that brings it to moor at his wharf, and if any person assists at unloading, handling, or storing it, he shall ever be deemed an enemy to his country and never be employed by his fellow citizens. Well, that's what happened. The colonists got together and they said, enough already. We're not going to allow global free trade to run our country, thank you very much. We're going to take a hand in it. We're going to have a country of, by, and for the people, not the so-called free market, and certainly not the robber barons and the transnational corporations. 27 minutes past the hour. Your call's next here live on the 4th of July.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Wanna shout out?
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God entitled them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. I received an email from Diane. I don't know if she wants her last name on the air, so I'm not going to say it. She says, Tom, every 4th of July, I enthusiastically and proudly read the Declaration of Independence and the preamble to the Constitution. This year, my heart is heavy with what has transpired in the last few days. And, of course, the last 6 years, I'm very worried about our country and our ability to ever have an honest government again. And then she quotes from the Declaration of Independence. She says, it stands out most clearly. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, I point out in the original John Locke's Second Treatise on Government in the 1760s, he wrote life, liberty, and private property. Life, liberty, and estate is how it originally was written. Jefferson changed that. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such ways that it shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. safety and happiness. This is Maslow's threshold. This is he's not talking here about that it shall be most likely to affect the free market. No, doesn't say that at all. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object, and by the way, that object at that time was the profit motive for the East India Company, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Well, Diane, don't give up. Don't despair. There are a lot of us out here who still remember why this country was founded, the ideals on which it was founded, and what it can be. I really, really and truly believe this is burned into our DNA. This is a part of who we are. And it's not going to go away. You've got all these cons out here with all their talking points and all the, you know, all the right wing stuff and all the so-called free market stuff. Let's just turn it over to the global corporations. ExxonMobil and General Motors will tell us what our energy policy and our transportation policy should be. Thank you very much. No. There's enough of us who remember that this country was not made great by the robber barons. The robber barons made themselves wealthy on the greatness of this country. But this country was not made great by the robber barons. It was made great by the laborers, by the people. Kim, driving in Missouri. Hey, Kim, welcome to the program.
Yes.
Hey,
can
Kim,
you hear me?
What's up? I can.
Okay. I listen to you. First of all, where do you get your tidbits? Those pamphlets, you know, they're not in print, are they?
That stuff, you can find that in two books of mine. Actually, I was reading when I was doing that rant is I was reading from What Would Jefferson Do, and also from, you know, from the original book by Hughes, which I also have here, but I reprinted a good chunk of it in What Would Jefferson Do, and you'll also find it, which is a book that I wrote, and you'll What Would Jefferson Do, A Return to Democracy, and also you'll find it in another book I wrote called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights.
Well, I'm just going to make one fast comment, and then I'm going to get to my point. No wonder the neocons are so fearful of people like you, because you add meat to why, you know, in other words, you're not just giving opinion, but you're adding meat to it, and they fear that.
Well, that's what I think we all need to do. We need to understand the historical perspective. We need to understand what this country was founded on, and they're out there aggressively trying to rewrite history.
The sad thing is, though, we have, even from our side, the progressive side, we have people that don't read, and all they give on the airwaves is their opinion. An opinion doesn't mean anything if you don't have meat.
Well, eventually what happens is that gets weeded out. You know, I mean, at a certain level, I do believe in competition, and I do believe that that quality wins out over time.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's probably why this radio show is on more stations live coast to coast than any other progressive radio show in existence. And you know, not to pat myself on the back too much. That's always dangerous.
I'll pat you on the back for you.
But, thank you. But not to put too fine a point on it, but I do think that there are a lot of progressives who are right across the board, both in radio and in print, who are realizing that. You know, complaint radio or complaint writing or whatever isn't enough. We have to dip back into the founding ideals of this country and share them with people and wake people up to them.
That's right. But have you noticed one thing? That the more people, the neocons, scream about free market and free competition, the more that they are the ones that are, through quote, freedom of this and freedom of that act, taking away our freedoms.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the bottom line. Your suggestion, Kim, that the conservatives want to oppress us with their words is spot on. It is.
I hate to say this. I've talked with you before. Our country, they're adopting the communist methods that they use in China against us, only with money.
Yeah.
And
no,
we are becoming communistic.
Well, I wouldn't say communistic, but it's the extreme end of capitalism, actually. It's laissez-faire capitalism. It's when absolutely unregulated capitalism is what you end up with is robber barons. We had robber barons in the late 19th century from 1880 until 1900. We had robber barons rising up. And then from after this blip from 1901 to 1918, the progressive era in the United States, from 1918 until the Republican Great Depression of 1929, we had a second rising up of robber barons, and now we have a third rising up of robber barons. And it, what goes along with rising up of robber barons is a decrease in taxes on the very wealthy and wiping out of the middle class. It's real simple. And, you know, we're going through the exact same cycle again. And frankly, I think we're at the tail end of it. I think we're very much at the tail end of it. America's starting to turn around. I'm very encouraged right now on this 4th of July, more so than I was 5 years ago when we started broadcasting this program, right, actually, just before the 4th of July. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Tom, I gotta tell you, you've made my holiday. I'm talking to my favorite patriot on my nation's birthday, and it's a thrill, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rich.
I wanted to just make a quick comment and get your thoughts on it as I listened to your guest previously about on the topic of energy independence. And you're uniquely qualified to speak on this since you're a citizen of Portland, which seems to be one of those municipalities that is really leading the way in the green movement.
We've actually beat the Kyoto Accords here in Portland, Oregon.
Exactly. And there's several hundred American cities that have agreed to meet the Kyoto Accords. And if you look at the wind farms in Texas, you look at the solar initiative in California, it seems like municipalities and states are leading the way. And I know that part of the reason is because it's fiscally rewarding for them.
Bill Richardson brags on the campaign trail about the fact that the entire state of New Mexico has beat the Kyoto Accords.
Right. And I know, do you think it's also, I'd like to get your thoughts on why you think that is. Are they less under the yoke of the lobbyist groups? And is the financial reward enough? Is that why you think they're leading the way? And I want to get your thoughts on that, just specifically since you're from Portland.
Sure.
I think there's
three things, Rich. Number one, being environmentally progressive doesn't require, and thanks a lot for the call. It doesn't require that you be fiscally stupid or business stupid. So you've got a lot of communities that are saying, okay, if we move from energy source A to energy source B, and energy source B works better for us, and we provide some incentives to make that happen, we're going to push industry to make that happen faster than it would normally happen in the so-called free marketplace, that's actually going to be a healthy thing for us economically. So that's happening. So actually what you have is the new lobbyists replacing the old lobbyists in some way. I mean, you got, you know, the people who are promoting green power coming in and knocking on the doors of the politicians and just, you know, and saying, hey, you know, we can do the same job only better that the guys who were knocking on your door an hour ago from the oil companies are doing. So, you know, in a way it's sort of meet the new boss same as the old boss, except that the new boss is a little less toxic. But the larger point is that what is happening in communities across America, and what you're seeing in even in states like, you know, report like California with a Republican governor, is that in many cases the people through their elected representatives are saying, no, there's a better way to do this, and we're gonna set aside some of our own resources, some of our tax dollars, in order to incentivize these kind of programs. We're going to give tax breaks, we're going to tax cuts and tax incentives to green energy, because we really don't want to breathe all this smog anymore. We don't want our kids having emphysema, one of the highest emphysema rates in the industrialized world. We don't want all these cancers. We want a better country. And we don't want to be dependent on Middle Eastern oil.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
We all need to be standing up and speaking out. Welcome back to the program. The wonders of technology. We're broadcasting live today from a studio in in our home where Louise and I live with Higgins and Louise's three cats. In fact, my headphones, I was complaining to Louise earlier. I said, these headphones are broken. You know, it's an old pair of Bose headphones, and the Higgins knocked them on the floor and went at them one day. But we're, you know, running this thing through a little Mackie mixer into a 10-year-old Zephyr, sitting in a houseboat out on a river in Portland, and the wires going down probably 150 feet of dock above 30 feet of water up to shore, and somehow it just magically works, to the magic digital telephone lines going to New York where Chris and Lauren are putting the show together in Manhattan, and then they beam it up to the satellite, which beams it to your radio station, and off we go. In fact, maybe Higgins will drop in and say hi a little later on in the program. Anyhow, time for a real quick here crazy alert. Yeah, I'm going to get a little more serious, actually, about the Cheney story in a few minutes. But this from the wire services, they say, in a bold new strategy to avoid a congressional subpoena, Vice President Dick Cheney today declared himself a national monument. Mr. Cheney took the unorthodox step only after failing in his attempt to invoke a little-known legal principle called the separation of Cheney and state. Aides to Mr. Cheney confirmed that being a national monument gives the vice president not only immunity from subpoenas, but also a draft deferment in perpetuity. President George W. Bush presided over a solemn White House ceremony this morning in which a plaque documenting Mr. Cheney's status as a national monument was affixed to the vice president's midsection. Joining the ranks of the Washington Monument and Lincoln Memorial, Mr. Cheney is believed to be the only landmark in the nation's capital, not at least partially made out of marble. But even as his attempts to evade a subpoena appear to have succeeded, the vice president's new status as a national monument created unexpected problems as Independence Day tourists lined up around the block to get a glimpse of Washington's latest historic attraction. Perhaps in an effort to control the crowds, Mr. Cheney announced today that admission price for seeing him would be set at $75,000. White House spokesman Tony Snow defended the $75,000 price tag, saying that it was an appropriate price to see a national monument of Dick Cheney's stature. $75,000 is what it costs to see Dick Cheney, Mr. Snow said. Just ask any lobbyist. Elsewhere, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said that everyone in the U.S. should go about their normal activities, except you terrorists out there. Yeah, except for you terrorists out there. It's
All those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
No, I don't think so. 953, welcome back. By the way, thanks to Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com, for a little bit of levity for the day. Janet in Long Beach, California. Hey, Janet, welcome to the program. Janet?
Oh, hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I really appreciated hearing the Franklin Roosevelt speeches that you aired on your show, and it gave me an idea, and I just want to see what you think of it.
Okay.
I was thinking perhaps we can promote and make live again FDR through these speeches in salon environments. If all of us who want to make a difference could get a hold of these speeches and invite people over in a social salon environment to share his wisdom.
Yeah, you know, that would be a marvelous project for somebody like Robert Greenwald, a kind of a history of the United States, a summary history of the United States with some of the early stuff, you know, done with actors. Robert Greenwald, he does, you know, he did the Walmart high price of high, you know, of low cost movie and the Fox News expose. He's done a lot of Brave New Films, I think, is his company. He's doing
well. How would I get a
stuff.
Hold of him?
Well, you know, I'll pass the idea along to him. I know him, and I think it's a great idea, and you know, provide
because
him
I would be
with kind of a historical
first
context.
Up, first, I have to know how to get hold of the tapes, and anyone who's listening. You know, we can invite people over and maybe do this through the Democratic clubs or, and here's one more idea I have. I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if an actor could in a theatrical setting, do FDR the way Hal Holbrook did Mark Twain?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I would find an actor or somebody like that to do something like, you know, Lincoln or Jefferson or the Boston Tea Party guys or whatever. But I think Franklin Roosevelt did a great job of Franklin Roosevelt. And it's just a matter of tracking down the video. Janet, thank you very much. Interesting idea. Bill in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
Great, but I'll get better. I'm having a fine time here on the 4th of July.
I've been trying to get through to you for months and months, and I finally made it. I really appreciate your show, especially when you have Senator Sanders on. Well, we need some more like him, I'll tell you. Anyway, the lady you were talking to a while back about, she was saying about the marketplace will take care of itself. Right. You know, I don't know where people get these ideas. The marketplace.
It's a religion.
Huh?
It's a religion.
You know, we're a nation of almost 300 million people, and two-thirds of those are idiots.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say that. You know, I'd say that two-thirds of us are too busy with, you know, just trying to get by to pay attention to the political discourse. That's the tragedy of America, is that the conservatives looked at what was happening in the 60s and 70s when 35% of Americans had union jobs, which meant 70% of Americans, because for every union job, there's typically an identical job in the non-union sector because the union jobs set the floor. So 70% of Americans had the ability to put their kids through school, had health care, had a pension. They were safe. They were secure. And they, you know, with just a 40-hour work week, they could do all this. And so what they did was they said, okay, in my spare time, I'm going to get involved with politics, with civics. And they got out on the streets, and women were demanding rights, and union workers were demanding rights, and African Americans were demanding rights. And the conservatives looked at this is terrible. We've got to impoverish this middle class.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back to the second hour of our live 4th of July program. Tom Hartman here with you, live on the air from Los Angeles to New York City and many, 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 many places in between. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Senator Mike Gravel is joining us, one of the Democratic candidates for President of the United States. His website, Gravel, spelled like gravel, G-R-A-V-E-L, 2008.us. And Senator Gravel, first of all, welcome to the program.
Well, Tom, thank you for having me on this glorious birthday.
It is. It is the birthday of our republic and the birthday of an extraordinary ideal, this ideal that George Washington said when he said, as our quote for the day, as mankind becomes more liberal, they will be more apt to allow that all those who conduct themselves as worthy members of the community are equally entitled to the protections of civil government. I hope ever to see America among the foremost nations of justice and liberality.
There's a reason why he's my hero of heroes. There's no in the world's history that I place higher than George.
He was a good guy. I want to thank you, by the way, for standing up to the conventional wisdom, to the powers in Washington, D.C., for changing the dialogue in the Democratic debates and in the debates in general, for speaking back to the power and breaking through the happy talk that so often dominates these debates. I think it's marvelous that you're doing that, even though in many of these areas you and I don't agree. I still think it's marvelous that you're doing it.
Well, thank you very much. We could pursue where we don't agree because I don't know where we would find those. But understand that it's going to get tougher. You know, to put it mildly, the other candidates are going to get pissed off. They are pissed off. They're going to do more. You know, they would like me to just disappear. But this is the same problem I had when I was in the Senate. I was a maverick, and I never viewed having power that it's got to be a personality cult or complex or happiness. That we need to come at each other so that people can see the confrontation and judge the information, and that's the only way they're ever going to evaluate these candidates for president, whether it's me or Hillary or Obama. And if they can't stand the heat of a lively discussion, that in itself proves they're not qualified to be president.
Yeah, then they should get out of the kitchen, as Harry Truman said. There's a variety, as you said, there's a variety of areas where we're in absolute agreement. Your position on the Iraq war, let's get out within 60 days. You've very eloquent about this over your website, gravel2008.us, that we should not be pursuing a military confrontation with Iran. This is crazy. That global warming is real. Your statement on LGBT rights and supporting same-sex marriage, I think, is great. Social Security, Veterans Affairs, you know, fund it, education.
Don't forget the war on drugs. We've got to get...
Yeah, prison and drugs. Yeah, in fact, go ahead.
Well, no, it's just it's horrible. You know, who in American culture doesn't know that prohibition was a total social failure in this country? Created a criminalized element that we're still living with today, and
right.
Turned around and put a bunch of people in jail, and it was just unjust. And
yeah.
The worst thing of all, it created a disrespect for the law, and that is the beginning of a lawless society. And that's what what's going on right now with respect to the war on drugs.
Yeah, 2.3 million people behind bars. This is absolutely nuts. We have more people in jail than any other country in the world on a per capita basis or in absolute numbers. I mean,
mm-hmm.
China is starting to catch up with this. We don't know fully, but it's mind-boggling. Your support of Roe v. Wade, I salute. Your support of Second Amendment rights with the caveat that saying if you have to have a driver's license to move 6,000 pounds of steel down the road, maybe you should have a license to own a gun that demonstrates some competence. I'm paraphrasing. That's my
right.
language.
No, you're an expert. Now, where do we disagree, Tom?
Okay, well, the areas where we disagree, I think, are number one, your suggestion of the fair tax. You see, there's only one entity in the U.S. that pays taxes, the individual.
Could we
I strongly disagree. Corporations are entities. They're not persons.
But we said, Tom, could we pursue that a little bit? Because
sure.
I may be able to win you over.
Okay, try it.
Okay, first up, there's two elements to it. One, which is a subset, which is taxing corporations. A corporation, you're quite right, they're entities, but what they're entities to produce products. And so they need resources. So you got to go buy the resources. Then you got to add labor to have a finished product. Then what you do is you got to add a little bit of profit, otherwise you're not in business the next year. And then when government taxes you or when you got to carry the health care system, those costs then go on to the product. So at the end, who is taxed, who pays this, all these elements, it's the consumer. So,
I disagree with your original premise. You said that corporations are entities designed to create a product, and they're not. Corporations, by law, are entities designed to create a profit. They create a product as a means to the end of creating a profit. But only a nonprofit corporation that does manufacturing, of which there are very, very few in the United States, would be a corporation that's created to create a product. A nonprofit corporation's first job is to do whatever it's chartered to do. If you have a nonprofit school or a nonprofit hospital, it's designed to provide education or health care. But if you have a for-profit school or a for-profit hospital, its first job is not education or health care. Its first job is to make a profit. And what that means is that somebody has put up that capital. I'm speaking from experience here. I've started 7 companies, one of which has generated over $250 million in revenue over the years, and most of it long after I sold it, but nonetheless, I've been there. And I'm telling you, a corporation is making profit. And so what you're taxing with that corporate income tax is you're taxing the people who put the money into it or the original effort into it that caused it to make that profit. If you're taxing people, you're taxing the corporate entity. You're taxing the stockholders.
Tom. I don't dispute what you're saying. But now, does the consumer pay for that or not?
No.
Call it a profit.
No. No, the stockholders pay for it.
So the consumer isn't going to pay for whatever the obscene or excess profits that you talk about. They're not going to pay for that.
The consumer is paying for the profits. I would suggest that you go back and read David Ricardo's paper in 1818. He wrote this paper called...
It's been a long time since I've read, I probably read it in school.
Well, let me just recap it in less than a minute, okay? In less than 30 seconds. What David Ricardo said is that the price of a product in the marketplace has nothing to do with taxes, it has very little to do with the cost of labor, and it doesn't even necessarily have anything to do with the cost of raw materials. All of those things are variables, but the major thing that will determine the price of a product in the marketplace is what the marketplace will support. In other words, when Phil Knight figured out that he could make Nikes cheaper in China than in Malaysia, and his price of manufacturing went down. The price of Nikes didn't go down because the market would support a higher price. So the market is what defines the price.
Yeah,
and so if you increase the taxes on something.
Which is the whole theory of elasticity is in there. So that can vary as to, you know, whatever the end result is what he's talking about. The end of elasticity is what the market will bear. You go
right
above the market, you won't sell your product.
That's right.
Okay.
And so if everybody is taxed at the same level, the market will simply incorporate that.
Tom, that I don't dispute that. What I'm saying is that whoever buys, you see, you're coming at it from a determinist point of view. I'm coming at it from the end product of who plunks the money down to buy the product.
Right. You're saying that the consumer is paying the tax that it's embedded
either way,
in the product, and I'm saying that the stockholder is paying that tax.
Not a stockholder. Don't pay a tax, Christ. Here, stop and think. Look at
they pay it in reduced dividends.
Oh, you think? Then they walk. Then the company fails. I mean,
well, not if it's not unless its dividends go below zero.
Well, but here again, you're it's a question. You're a little bit fudging the argument. What I'm saying is, you think that the consumers do not absorb it, that the shareholders absorb it.
That's right.
Not been my experience, and I've been around the horn a little bit too, Tom.
Well, it certainly was my experience in the marketplace. I couldn't raise or...
I don't doubt your experience. I'm just telling you my experience is that it's the people, the consumers, and, of course, when we talk about... It's a little bit when we say the word single payer. You know what single payer is? That's you, the citizen, the consumer, the taxpayer. There's only one person who pays. The government doesn't pay for health care. The government doesn't pay for defense. It's the people who pay for this.
Well, and the extent to which there is no government, there is just us operating through an institution we've created, which we happen to call government.
That's right.
I'm agreeing with you. But I just, you know,
but who else is there when you say single payer? You know, you think that there's...
So now we're talking about your universal health care
vouchers. Called investor, called... manager. Sure, they're out there, but they're just part of the total, and the total is that there's only one entity that pays for it all, and that is the individual in society. And so, with respect to corporations, that is called a consumer. Now,
okay, Senator Gravel, we have to pause to take a break here, but
okay.
We're talking with Senator Mike Gravel, his website, gravel2008.us. And the senator, I believe, will take. In fact, I know he'd be pleased to take your calls. Your questions,
that,
great.
But we could
so we'll take a couple listener calls when we come right back. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
No, it's not gone. We're taking it back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Live on Air America Radio, broadcasting coast to coast, podcasting all across the planet. Welcome back to our program. We have with us Senator Mike Gravel, one of the Democratic candidates for president. And he's going to be taking your calls now. And so let's start out with Dave in Buffalo, New York, who wants to continue our conversation, although I'm going to get myself out of the way on this because I've said my piece, I think. But Dave in Buffalo, you're live with Senator Mike Gravel.
I love both of you, and thank you, Tom. The President Mike Gravel, it's about sales tax. I would like you to have you explain to the world about sales tax. But before I go, all other candidates have a dream. President Mike Gravel has goals. The difference between a dream and a goal is action. President Mike Gravel is a man of goals and action. To both of you and anyone listening, peace.
Thank you, Dave, and happy 4th of July. Senator
David,
Gravel, by the way, gravel2008.us.
Thank you, Tom. And David, thank you. I thought that was well said. Let me explain it this way. And it's first off, a government, the most important thing a government does, and I might say that of all the domestic issues, I view this as the problem of taxation as the most important. Once we get that solved, the rest will fall into the space, into line very well. Now, the first task of government is to raise revenue. When it does that unfairly, what it does is it turns around and communicates to the people that they're not going to be treated fairly on the use of the revenue that the government creates. And so that is what we see today in our government. People don't like taxes. People don't trust the government, and with good reason, because they're not being treated fairly and the money is not well spent. So now we have two choices. You have the income tax, which is what we've been suffering under for a long time. The income tax has been gamed because we have representative government. It's been gamed by the wealthy in order to not pay taxes. And so the burden that the money that the government must collect then falls on the average citizen or the middle class. And so if you think that you're going to change that, which is what we all hope, it's, all I can say is, there's several decades to prove that you're wrong, that it can't be changed. And you don't see anybody talking about changing our system of taxation today. You see the likes of a Forbes that says we're going to have a flat tax, which is absolutely obscene. But just look at income tax is a tax on what you earn. The more you earn, the more you pay. But they've gamed the system so that the more you earn, the less you pay. Now, with the sales tax, it's also progressive because the more you spend, the more you pay in the way of taxes. Now we can make.
But Bill Gates doesn't spend most of his money; he invests.
Let me finish. Now, time you said you're going to hold off.
Okay, you're right. Okay. All right.
So now what happens is it's progressive by nature. So in the same way that the income tax is progressive by nature, but we know that the income tax has been corrupted to the benefit of Gates and Buffett, and they'll admit it. You know, so now let's look at the sales tax. We can make it progressive by turning around, more progressive than it is, by turning around and rebating the money that the citizen would pay for the essentials of life, because that's where the regression comes in on a comparative basis. And what are those? That's food, lodging, medicine, transportation, all of the important things. Now, we can't give an exception at the food store, because the minute you do that, the minute you have one exception, you now open the gate for wealth to game the system so you're back to where you started. So what we have to do is take an estimate, and that's not hard to figure out, what a average citizen or a person at the poverty level will be paying in a way of sales tax on the essentials of life, and then turn around and write a check to that person, which means everybody that signs up will get a check every month for the tax that person would be paying on the essentials of life at the poverty level or at the average level, whatever.
Okay. Whatever. People can learn more about this over at gravel2008.us.
That's right.
We only have a minute and a half left, and I want to get a couple more questions in here real quickly.
Okay.
Jake in Arcata, California, quick question for Senator Gravel.
Hey, Tom. You know, if that neocon artist Scooter Libby should not be forced to endure 30 months in Club Fed, then why should the United States be forced to endure 18 more months of Bush and Cheney? I think Tom's right that we need to remind the people that our country was founded in rebellion against the King George of England and his multinational corporate financiers. Now we have our own King George in America.
Senator Jake, Rebell, in short form, yeah, your question.
Support impeachment of Bush and Cheney.
I couldn't agree more with the statements you are making, but let me just add this to it. What he should have been convicted on and was not, he was convicted on lies because he was biting the bullet for the vice president. What they committed was treasonous. To give up the name of an agent is order of battle secrecy, and
so
we violate.
Do you
that,
support?
That
we only have 10 seconds left. Do you support impeachment of Bush and Cheney?
Oh, that's not even that. It's criminality. The impeachment.
So the answer is yes. You would support impeachment of them.
Yes, but it's not enough.
Oh, so impeachment and prosecution of them.
Of course, the prosecution. How many people died?
Yeah, as a consequence of their lies. Good point, Senator Mike Gravel. His website, gravel2008.us. Senator Gravel, thanks for being willing to come on and have this conversation with us. It's much appreciated.
Okay, and look forward to meeting in the flesh, and we could discuss at length the taxation policies.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
All good. It's all right. Well, it's always a good day when you're glad to be alive. Every day.
It's a beautiful day here on the 4th of July. Tom Hartman here broadcasting live from our studio where actually Louise and I live. It's not, you know, I said a houseboat earlier. It's not a, it doesn't have a motor. It's, we live in a house that is on these big metal pontoons that, you know, it's a small two bedroom, two bathroom basic house that happens to be sitting on top of 30 feet of water, 100 feet offshore out in a river in Portland. And, if you, you know, it starts getting loose, then you end up underwater. Oh, okay. But we're not underwater. So, we're broadcasting live from home today and having a fine time doing it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. By the way, when you call in, be sure to thank Lauren Kirchner and Chris Lopresto for showing up today in New York City at Air America and helping make this program work. I really appreciate it. Here we are on this holiday, and I think we're probably one of the few shows that's live today. Sarah in Alpine, Texas. Hey, Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Sarah.
I love you.
Well, thank you. What's up?
I was studying in history that about, you know, labor and business, and mm-hmm. if the Republicans don't want to regulate business because it's the government interfering with people's lives, how come they want to interfere with people's lives and regulate unions?
Because that's we the people. And
exactly.
Really, the bottom line is that the Republican and, frankly, many conservative Democrats, their interests lie with the interests of these large institutions, these global corporations that many of them don't even give a damn about the United States. Many of them, you know, Halliburton reincorporated Kellogg Brown and Root, the company that's getting all these multi-billion-dollar contracts to Iraq. They reincorporated in the Cayman Islands, so they wouldn't even have to pay U.S. income tax. So we pay for the commons, we pay for everything, and we pay the taxes that end up going to this company, but the stockholders, you know, they're paying no taxes at all, the corporation's paying no taxes at all. It's just absolutely wrong. It's wrong. There's no other way to say it. Sarah, thank you for the call. Mike in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. Thanks for taking the call. I'm a little bit concerned with some of what I'm hearing. I'm a liberal, but I think one problem with the liberal movement, among many, is economic naivete. And I say this because, you know, I think a lot of Americans anecdotally seem to have this sort of common sense intuitiveness in their gut that tells them that when you raise taxes on corporations, there are going to be fewer jobs, products are going to be more expensive.
But that's not the case, Mike. What happened when they lowered taxes on corporations with both the Clinton and the Bush administrations was that we got fewer jobs, we got lower quality jobs, and those corporations started moving their activities overseas. The highest tax rate that we had in the history of this country was put into place between Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower, those three presidents. And it existed through the presidencies of Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Johnson. And that period of time was the time that we had the greatest industrial productivity, the greatest growth of jobs in the history of the world, the greatest growth of jobs, and the strongest middle class. And the top marginal tax rate on income for individuals in this country was 90%, and the top marginal tax rate on profits for corporations was over 50%. Now, what you're saying is just not true. It's simply not true. When you lower taxes on corporations, you do not create jobs. In most cases, when you lower taxes on corporations, you simply give them more incentives for bad behavior.
The problem with what you're saying, though, is that that period of history you cite was a unique period in history in that it was post-World War II, and many economies overseas were wrecked and were still recovering.
The same is true of post-World War I. The exact same thing is true of post-World War I. The difference between post-World War I and post-World War II is that after World War I, we went with the robber barons and laissez-faire economics, and we said, okay, the tax rates are very, very low. There were five tax cuts in a row. After World War One, I forget if it was, I think it was Harding was the first president. I'd have to go back and look. I don't have the presidents of the 20th century listed and memorized in order, but we had a whole series of massive tax cuts in the 1920s, and that led to the rise of the robber barons. It led to the rise of very large corporations. It led to the rise of an incredible disparity in wealth between the average working person and the most wealthy in this country, and it led to the Republican Great Depression of 1929. It led to a disaster. It did not lead to an increase in the number of companies. It did not lead to an increase in the number of jobs. The Roaring Twenties were not roaring for the average worker, working person in the United States. They were only roaring for the robber barons.
Well, but what's going on now with globalization, it's true that now we actually had a lot of job growth under Clinton. Now it's true that wages were relatively stagnant, especially compared to the post-World War II.
Wages have been stagnant since Reagan came in and reconfigured the system.
But
I mean, go back and look at the statistics. Wages have been stagnant since the late 70s, actually.
Right, but it's an inevitability when you have increased global competition. And it's not a bad thing, because what it leads to ultimately is higher productivity, lower prices for consumers, and consumer surpluses that can be converted, that can be taxed and can be converted into social programs to help make up for displacement.
No, this is right-wing nonsense, Mike. I'm sorry. First of all, if I have to depend on slave labor in China to be making the products so that I can have cheap prices for consumer goods, I'd rather not have the consumer goods at the cheap prices. It's immoral what you're suggesting. Number one. If we're making those things in the United States like we used to, and we're paying somewhat higher prices for them like we used to, then we're getting a high salary like we used to. We used to be self-sufficient in the United States. Yes, it used to cost a lot more to buy a TV, but people made twice as much. People had higher salaries. I would much rather have a higher salary and pay a little more for the stuff at Walmart than see those jobs going over to China.
Well, I disagree, and I think it helps the Chinese, and I think it helps us. I would just ask.
It's helping the Chinese oligarchs. It's not helping the average Chinese person. In fact, the latest studies coming out from the World Bank show that poverty is actually increasing in China among the majority of people. There are these pockets of wealth, these fairly large pockets of wealth. We're talking millions and millions of people. But it's a country of over a billion people. The vast majority of people in China are actually getting poorer, while the disparity between the richest and poorest in China is increasing. Tom Friedman is wrong. I'm sorry. He sold us a bill of goods with the olive tree and the Lexus. It wiped out our middle class when Bill Clinton read it and believed it. And pushed through NAFTA and GATT, and it's continuing to wipe. And now the world is flat. He's wrong. He's just plain old flat out wrong. It's not the best thing for us. It is the best thing for billionaires like Tom Friedman, who is worth $3 billion, and it is the best thing for big transnational and global corporations. But it's not the best thing for democracy, and it's not the best thing for the United States, and it's certainly not the best thing for the working person in the United States.
Well, if we pay less for the goods that we buy, aren't the lower prices to some degree an offset for the lower salaries? Would you at least give me that?
No, I won't.
Well, so how is it then that the lower prices that we pay is not at least to some degree an offset of the lower wages and wage stagnation?
You can argue that it is to some degree, but the bottom line, Mike, is that we are either spiraling up or we're spiraling down. And if you look at the history of this country, you see that, there's this history of our spiraling up and spiraling down at different times. And every time we went into a period of robber baron economics, from 1870 to 1900, from 1918 to 1929, and from 1980 to today, for example, robber baron economics, and then the other one was from 1830 to 1864. Every time we did that, what happened was the middle class got wiped out, the average working person made less and less, and at the very, very top, wealth got accumulated. So I would say that you're making less and your stuff is cheaper. Isn't that wonderful? No, it's not wonderful, because you're making so much more less than the stuff is cheaper that the net value of Americans is diminishing. Americans are becoming poorer. We have, we had net negative savings rate last year for the first time since the Great Depression. Isn't that a flag to you that this isn't working?
But I think that would be an argument for Senator Gravel's approach to move to consumption-based taxation. I would do it progressively as well, but use a value-added tax that you tax every added value process that goes into a product or service. Therefore, those who can afford the better products with luxury cars, for example, would be taxed at a higher rate than your economy cars.
Yeah, this is how it's done in Europe. And a value-added tax is really just a fancy way of burying a whole bunch of sales taxes in series, so that they're invisible to the consumer. I'm frankly not an advocate of a value-added tax either. The bottom line is that a consumption tax, in my opinion, any kind of consumption tax, is ultimately a regressive tax because it hits people who consume. And the fact of the matter is that people who have very very, very high incomes, you know, massive high incomes, are not by and large consumers. They're by and large investors. In fact, the Wall Street Journal refers to them as the investor class. And Bush rejiggered the tax code, changed our tax code so that those people pay a maximum now of 15% income tax on income from dividends and capital gains, in investment income. And, you know, so the Bush family is paying a maximum of 15% tax, but you and I, people who work for a living, are paying a maximum of 35% income tax. And not only that, you only pay Social Security in the first $90,000 that you make. So the Bush family, you know, making their billions or their hundreds of millions, they're paying absolutely no income tax whatsoever beyond that first $90,000. And the vast majority of people working in America, median income in the United States, 44,000. The vast majority of working people in America are paying the full load. You know, 100% of their income is taxed. So it's just it's a system that's absolutely wrong. Mike, I appreciate your strong defense of the system, but I encourage you to look at the real numbers out there and look at the real stories, the real situation of what's going on in this country. Global competition, as you call it, is not a good thing. There's 6 billion people who want your job and will do it for a buck an hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
By the way, I want to share with you some insights. I think I've figured out what actually happened with the whole Cheney Libby thing. I'll tell you about that in the next hour. I just want to put a punctuation mark on my comments with my conversation with Mike in the last segment. In the context of Thomas Jefferson, and you'll find this information in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? In April of 1770, Jefferson, this is when he was in his early 20s, and this is a young man, April of 1770. Jefferson was practicing law and defending his very first case, Howell versus Netherland, was defending a freed slave who had been recaptured. And he said, under the law of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with the right of his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will. In 1769, as a legislator in Virginia, he'd written a bill to abolish slavery. He was punished for that. Punished heavily, by the way, by laws being passed that made it even harder for anybody in Virginia, including Jefferson, to do anything good for or to free their slaves. In 1783, he unsuccessfully attempted to amend the Virginia Constitution, proposing language that said, quote, the General Assembly shall not permit the introduction of any more slaves to reside in this state or the continuance of slavery beyond the generation which shall be living on the 31st day of December, 1800, all persons born after that day being hereby declared free. It did not pass. And then I've got, you know, 4 pages of continued efforts over and over and over again where Jefferson tried to end slavery in the United States unsuccessfully. And the reason that I bring this up, and in fact, even just before he died, 1820, Jefferson was president from 1800 to 1808. Or from 1801 to 1809, if you want to go from inauguration to, you know, the day he left. And so here we are, April 22nd, 6 years before he died in 1820, April 22nd, 1820. Congressman John Holmes of Massachusetts, who is an old friend, writes a letter to the elderly Thomas Jefferson informing him of the Missouri Compromise. And the Missouri Compromise was Missouri was a slave state, Maine was a non-slave state. They wanted to admit Missouri into the Union, but there was the Constitution said after 1808 there should be no more slave states, there should be no more slavery. And so they decided to just ignore that, and that was something Jefferson had fought to get into the Constitution, and Madison as well, oddly. I mean, these guys from Virginia. Because he foresaw a day when the nation would be torn apart across what he called the geographical line over the issue of human beings being considered a kind of property. This is his language. And so he sends a letter to John Holmes, who informs him of the Missouri Compromise, that they're gonna let in another slave state, Missouri. And he writes back, he says, I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you've been so kind to send me of your letter to your constituents on the Missouri question. It is a perfect justification to them. I have for a long time ceased to read newspapers or pay any attention to public affairs, confident that they were in good hands, and content to be a passenger in our bark, in our canoe, to the shore from which I am not distant. In other words, he's knowing that he's about to die. He said, but this momentous question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened me and filled me with terror. I consider it at once the death knell of the Union. It is hushed indeed for the moment. But this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence. Now, see, in this letter, he is predicting the Civil War. A geographical line, this is the Mason-Dixon line, a geographical line coinciding with a marked principle that moral and political, once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper. I can say with conscious truth that there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us of this heavy reproach in any practicable way. And then he goes on and he talks about how slavery in the United States makes us traitors to the world, treason against the hopes of the world. He said, I regret that I am now to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons, and that my only consolation is to be that I will not live to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings they will throw away against an abstract principle more likely to be affected by union than by scission, he's talking about slavery here, they would pause before they would perpetrate this act of suicide on themselves and of treason against the hopes of the world. That was Jefferson in his old age, in 1820. Now, it's easy for us in this day and age to look back 200 years and criticize Jefferson for slavery, for his slaves. He used the cheap labor resource of his slaves to maintain his lifestyle, and the consequence of the failure of his efforts to abolish slavery was a bloody civil war followed by 100 years of legal apartheid. And although he rationalized his slaveholding by keeping them in a style that exceeded that of most poor whites of the day, both were grim by today's standards, it was nonetheless a rationalization of slavery. Jefferson's lifestyle was made possible by slave labor, and there's no other way to say it. Recognizing that fact, many Americans are righteously indignant and quick to judge him harshly. Yet how many of us would willingly free our slaves? The computer I'm looking at right now was made in China. The jeans I'm wearing were made in Malaysia. I can rationalize all the products of distant slaves that I use. After all, I don't have to look in their faces like Jefferson did. But it's still just a rationalization. The stark reality is that we in America didn't end slavery. We simply exported it. It's so much more comfortable for us to criticize Jefferson for agonizing over but still using slave labor 200 years ago when we don't have to look into the faces of today's slaves who are toiling and dying at this very moment to sustain our lifestyles. Thomas Friedman's arguments, the whole world is flat arguments, all this stuff, this is all the justification, the ongoing justification of worldwide slavery so that we can continue to use the benefits of that slave labor and somehow justify, somehow feel good about it. I'm sorry, I don't feel good about it. 57 minutes past it.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes... Welcome back, by the way. Third hour of our program live on the 4th of July. It's 6 minutes after 11 on the West Coast, where I am here in Portland, Oregon, and 6 minutes after 2 in the afternoon on the East Coast, and 6 minutes after someplace and all places in between and outside. Sometimes you know what's so, sometimes you're not sure, sometimes you don't know what isn't so, sometimes it's important for you to get listening to our Everything You Know Is Wrong alert, eh?
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know, We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. And if one looks throughout the history of our country and other free countries, it is the latter category that tend to be the difficult ones.
The latter category, the unknown unknowns. Jim Gerard has laid out for us the unknown unknowns that actually many Americans are very concerned about. The best-selling books in the world right now, with over 50 million copies in print, the Left Behind series, all about the rapture. So Jim Gerard is explaining it all. A Heathen's Guide to the Rapture. The title of the book is Beam Me Up, Jesus. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I've been an admirer of your show for some time, so I was happy to come on.
Well, thank you. You've got some really interesting tips in this book. How does one protect oneself, for example, against demonic locusts?
Well, the first thing people have to know when the rapture comes is that there's going to be so many calamities that they have to prioritize which ones they have to protect themselves against first. There's plagues and earthquakes, a giant meteor called Wormwood that's going to destroy half the planet. And, you know, if they can survive all that, then they have to face the smoke locusts.
Right. So let's say we've made it all the way through to the locusts. So what do we do?
Well, there's also some survival tips about hunting and other kinds of things, that foraging for nuts and berries, and but those are for the left behind people, of course.
I see. Okay. We're talking with Jim Gerard, the author of Beam Me Up, Jesus. His website, gangof60, as in 60.com. Jim, how to protect yourself against giant demonic clothes? How to handle coitus rapturuptus, that embarrassing moment when your partner suddenly disappears while you're making love.
That's a tough one. Viagra can't help you with that.
So, I guess, be prepared emotionally. Is that your advice?
Yeah, because this could happen at any time. You know, since the rapture believers think that this could happen at any time, I just presume that it could happen in the bedroom. As well as anywhere else.
In your book, you have a list of how to get on the Rapture A list. What are some of the things that will make it, you know, increase the probability that, you know, I know, you know, Jesus in the New Testament talked at length, and this is, you know, something I've read several times, talked at length about how, you know, a rich man couldn't get into heaven. This fellow came to him and said, the centurion came to him and said, you know, or the rich guy came to him and said, how do I get into heaven? He says, sell everything you own, give it to the poor. And the guy walked away very sad because, you know, he wasn't willing to sell everything he owned.
Right.
So here you've got Jerry Falwell just died a multimillionaire. Pat Robertson is a billionaire.
Yeah.
Are these guys in trouble? And if they're not in trouble, what did they do that got them on the A-list for the rapture that those of us who aren't millionaires or billionaires should be thinking about?
Well, I actually have a little chapter in the book about the people who believe with certainty that they're going to be raptured, but almost certainly will not be raptured. And into that category falls the aforementioned people, the Pat Robertsons of the world. But as far as how to get on the rapture A-list, make friends with the bouncer. That's always the first step.
At the pearly gates, you mean?
Yeah, take flying lessons, because people are going to be levitated or teleported. I don't know what the word is, too, up to heaven. 144,000, by the way, of the chosen.
Right, only 144,000.
Only 144,000.
Right.
So there's going to be a lot of PO'd Christians.
Yeah, the number is pretty small. The Maharishi's folks, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the Transcendental Meditation folks,
right.
Have flying lessons.
Oh, okay. So there
would
you
that
go.
Help?
You could probably, sign up with him for a while and, Or the FAA, you know, or your local private.
Yeah. And you can always tell a doorman that you're with Madonna. Is that the
right? That's the another one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting thinking and an interesting book. Beam Me Up, Jesus: A Heathen's Guide to the Rapture by Jim Girard. Jim, gangof60.com, the website. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Adding a little levity to our 4th of July program. 12 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number. Scott, back to. You know, the issues of the day. Scott in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Scott, what's up? Scott? No, Scott. Okay, let's try Annette in Linden, New Jersey. Hey, Annette.
Hey, Tom, how are you? I love the show.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, was anybody paying attention to Keith Olbermann last night?
Yeah, what a rant, calling on Cheney and Bush to resign.
I was stunned. I T-voted it, so my husband would be able to watch it when he got home from work.
Yeah, and in fact, over at thinkprogress.org, they've got a video of it. I'm sure it's all over YouTube. Keith Olbermann is, I've said it many times, he's one of the few real journalists that we have on television. He's the Edward R. Murrow of our age. Edward R. Murrow, obviously his hero, the guy that he uses as sign-off for, and it really and truly was a great rant that Olbermann did last night. And in fact, that reminds me, I thank you for the call. I've been wanting to talk about this. It was let me find the original story here. I know I've got it. Here we are. January 18, 2007. Okay, now just kind of, you know, into the Wayback Machine. I'm sorry, that was not it. That was, yeah, January 18th, 2007, January 18th of this year. Now this is July 4th, 2007. So we're only looking back 6 months, five and a half. Okay, five and a week. But on January 18th of 2007, it was day 3 of jury selection for the Scooter Libby trial, and Scooter Libby's lawyer Ted Wells went up to a juror number 3, the third juror who was being interrogated, and said, you know, what do you think about the Iraq war? And she said it was a tremendous mistake, and she felt betrayed by the war. He then asked her what she thought about Vice President Cheney. And she said, I think he's been instrumental in enacting some policies that have damaged our country. He then said, do you think you could be fair in this case and listen only to the evidence presented? She said, yes. And then Libby's lawyer, Ted Wells, said, and I quote, this is a verbatim quote from the transcript of this day in court, January 18th of this year, in the Scooter Libby trial. His lawyer, Ted Wells, said, Vice President Cheney will be a witness in this case. If his testimony is contradicted by another witness who you don't know or who you have no feelings about, would your feelings about the vice president make it difficult for you to fairly evaluate the credibility of the vice president? So in other words, he was saying not only was he going to present a strong defense, but he was going to present a strong defense that involved calling Dick Cheney to the stand and also calling somebody to the stand who was going to contradict Dick Cheney. That was January 18th. By February, within a few weeks, Ted Wells had zipped his lip. Scooter Libby, Irving Lewis Libby, was no longer offering a defense. He offered no defense whatsoever. He called virtually no witnesses other than character witnesses. Basically, what Irving Lewis Scooter Libby had his lawyers do was say, stop bringing Cheney into this. Stop bringing, you know, the whole war thing into this. No more discussion of Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame. None of that. I'm going to go to jail. I submit to you that on January 18th, when Ted Wells confronted that juror and said that he was going to subpoena Cheney, that day or the next day, Cheney's people had a conversation with Libby's people, and it became very clear to Scooter Libby and his lawyers that he would never go to jail. And that he would never suffer for this if he kept his mouth shut. Because he just rolled over and played dead. And now it's come to fruition. That was when it began.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
us more. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrow's where it ends. What we do today, don't stay the course on a horse that's going the wrong way.
And we're not. In the news, Democratic candidates are out fundraising Republican candidates dramatically. Why? People are just saying, you know, we got it. The Republicans are sold out to the big multinational, transnational, global, whatever you want to call them, these giant corporations that have no loyalty to you or me. They have no loyalty to any particular nation. They only serve profit. And they do not serve humanity. That's the purpose of governments. Governments are instituted by and among men, as, you know, paraphrasing from the Constitution, quoting from the Constitution, actually from the Declaration of Independence. Today, the birthday of the 4th of July. In order to further the goals of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This ain't rocket science. And all over the world, people are looking at what's going on with these conservative policies and saying, nah, enough. I mean, look at how many countries in South America just in the last couple of two, 3 years. Mexico, within a hair's breadth, frankly, I think that Alberto, whatever his name was, won that election, and that the liberal candidate, and many other countries, I mean, moving in that direction. Well, I guess we had a little setback in France, but you see, a conservative in France would be a screaming liberal in the United States. Nobody's arguing in France that they should privatize their healthcare system or that they should do away with free college education for everybody. I mean, the argument is, should there be a maximum 35-hour week or a maximum 38-hour work week? I mean, that kind of thing. Michael in Glendale, California. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for waiting so long. What's up?
Oh, it's not a wait at all. This, you know, I'm thinking back to your first hour when you read the email from Diane.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it so well. This is like my bipolar day. You know, it's such an up and down when you're talking about July 4th and these great people. But I want to let Diane know and everybody else out there, it's tag We're It.
Yeah.
When we have people like you guys and Diane, as you as well, and these wonderful people that call into the station, we are it, and we can do this. And I know we can do this, and I hear the buzz everywhere. I'm not in the best position to scream and be heard, but I still scream and I still am heard, and then those people will scream. So we are doing this, and this is the day that this is our Independence Day. This isn't a birthday in my sense. This is our Independence Day. Air America lifts us up, and we lift them up, and we lift up together, and we're going to squash these people because they don't have an agenda with an ending. All they have.
Yeah, well, in fact, here's what I think might even be a better goal, Michael, is instead of squashing these people, let's squash their ideas and then bring them over to our side.
Yeah. Okay, Tom. Yeah. Yeah. You're such a Buddhist. But
I guess ultimately it's.
We all are. But you know what? That's what I'm getting at. It's not that we need to ignore them, because obviously we don't. But if we lift ourselves up and our values, and it makes me cry, actually. I have a 9-year-old son, and I adore him, and I teach him about these great people that started this idea that blossomed and that never worked before because enough people didn't believe in it, but these great people that did that. And, you know, you actually hurt yourself a little while ago, because every time I listen to you, you're such a great orator and a fantastic debater, but of course you are if you know what you're talking about. But then you go ahead and you read something from Jefferson or Madison, those beautiful men, and then I remember how, you know, you're a titan, but they're the gods. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
hugely amazing. So thank you for the 4th of July and the Tom Hartman Show. Yes, I've been waiting for 2.5 hours, but you know what, Mr. Hartman? That is not a wait at all. It's my honor, and this is my fireworks. If you ask me, and I am prattling on, but I'll make it quick because I know there's many people out there that want to laud this day as well. If you ask me that every dime spent today on everything that's blown up or coloring the sky or cooked on a barbecue, all that money should go to the veterans of this country, and that's really what would be a great 4th of July for me. Because I'm
well
working
said,
today,
well,
and I
well
let people
said.
Know that I do love this country, but in this in this atmosphere, the only thing that picks me up, and I'm not exaggerating, the only thing that picks me up is Air America people, because you guys are the Mount Rushmore. Yeah. Waiting to happen.
Well, and it even goes beyond Air America, because you're listening on K-Talk, and they carry a variety of programming. It is progressive programming. It is right across the board. It's happening all across the United States. It's all of us working together.
It makes my heart thump.
And, yeah,
and it just swells me, and that's what got people going. And for you to repeat it it just makes it like, this is no different than then. The best thing that we have going for us, Diane, if you're listening, is that we have communication today that they didn't have. So when they were in a tavern long ago saying, we're not going to sit down and put up with this, we're going to stand up, it took an entire day to cross the street at that time. This time, you can push a button and put your opinion down and know that you're not alone.
Right. Well said, Michael. Well said. Or it took months. And here's the ultimate irony. Michael says, so why don't we make sure that our efforts, our contributions, our money is going to our veterans. The USO is sending flags to veterans for July 4th, I believe it is. Flags, U.S. flags, made in China. What's wrong with this picture? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
And welcome to the Liberal Program. Here we are on the 4th of July. Not just the nation's birthday, but our Independence Day. Our Independence Day. And independence from what? As Franklin Roosevelt said in his 1936 speech, July in 1936 in Philadelphia, he said, that very word, freedom, implies freedom from some restraining force. In 1776, the founders fought a war against the restraining force of royal autocracy. I'm quoting this from memory, so I'm pretty sure that's exactly how he said it. He said, now we're confronted with new economic royalists, a new restraining force. And once again, we the people are rising up to take on this new restraining force and restore freedom to the United States. And that new restraining force, frankly, in my opinion, the largest piece of it, the largest manifestation of it, is money in politics. Susan Lerner is doing something about it. She's the executive director of California's Clean Money Campaign, Clean Elections by Public Financing. The website is CA, as in California, caclean.org. Susan Lerner, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom, thank you so much, and it is such an exciting conjunction to be talking to you on July 4th.
Yeah, isn't it cool? I mean, here we are, this extraordinary day, and this is really an extraordinary topic. I don't know if there's a news release or an article that you wrote, but you were talking about how the California Clean Money bill passed the California Assembly, and you note it wouldn't have passed without the help of activists like you. Tell us about first of all, where California is at with regard mm-hmm. to clean money, where the rest of the nation is at with regard to clean money, and for that matter, what do we mean by clean money?
Well, it's a pretty exciting time. What we mean by clean money is full public funding of elections. It's an alternative way to pay for our election campaigns so that we have an effective, efficient, functioning, representative government, which after all is what our founding fathers set up, that will be responsive to us, the people, and not the large campaign contributors, whether it's a wealthy individual, large corporation, or a powerful union, providing the money that puts strings on our elected officials. So full public funding of elections is an alternative form. We're not looking to restrict. We're not looking to punish. We are looking to open up the ballot, level the playing field, and make it possible for more ordinary citizens with a broad life experience to run for office. and to have an effective government that is responsive to us, the people.
Susan Lerner, we're talking with Susan Lerner, the executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign. How exactly would that work in California, and how close are you to it?
Well, the way it would work is a candidate agrees to accept spending limits and to forego private fundraising in exchange for receiving an amount of money that allows them to run an effective campaign once they show a broad base of support. Here in California, we're working at a number of different levels. Right now, there's a bill in the state Senate. It's going to have a hearing on July the 10th in the Elections Committee, AB 583, the Clean Money and Fair Elections Act, and it would put a measure on the ballot in June 2008 that would allow the voters to say yes. We want to try out full public funding of elections here in California. We want to run our gubernatorial election in 2010 with public funding.
Now, we arguably have this at the federal level. We, you know, you can check your thing on the on your IRS form, and yet most of the major candidates, Republican and Democratic, have in the last election cycle and probably in this election cycle decided not to go along with that, not to have those restrictions put on them in exchange for that money, because frankly there's so much more private money out there. How do you deal with that? Is there a mechanism to deal with it?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, the presidential system worked really, really well when it was first designed. The problem with it is that it's not self-correcting enough. All you have are cost of living increases, and as the cost of campaigning has shot up, the amount of public money in the presidential system didn't keep pace. So in the clean money systems that we have suggested, they adjust not only cost of living increases, but also the ability to amend the statute to provide more or less money, depending on how it's actually working. And also, we provide something which is not in the presidential system, and I think is the strongest part of a clean money system. If a clean money candidate is outspent, then they get a match, a dollar-for-dollar match up to a cap, so that they don't have to worry that if they're running against somebody who is a prodigious fundraiser or has great personal wealth, that they won't be able to keep up. And,
yeah.
Tom, your listeners should know that this system is working today in Arizona and Maine. And
well, it's also how we do it.
It's
also how we do it here in the city of Portland.
That's
and
correct.
We just had our first voter-owned election in the last election cycle, and Eric Sten, one of our members of our city council, it's called the city commission. He's called a city commissioner, who was one of the people who pushed for this public financing. He ran, and if you get 5,000 people to give you, or if you get 1,000 people to give you $5, and sign a petition, then that's proof that you have a broad base of support. And then you get, I believe it's $100,000 from the city. And so Eric did that. He got his $5,000, his 1,000 people. He got $100,000 from the city. And the local utility, which is a remnant of Enron, had one of their friends or lobbyists, I don't know exactly how to characterize the person who ran against Eric, and was supporting her campaign, and they went above the $100,000 and, you know, went to, as I recall, $125,000. So the city wrote a check for $25,000 to Eric, and it was just like, you know, what what was interesting about it wasn't just that, and Eric Sten ended up winning the election, by the way. It wasn't just that he got an amount of money that was equal to what his opponent was getting from the big corporations and the power utilities and the right wing, the other interests. But also that because it was a totally transparent process, it kept getting reported in the paper. So whenever his opponent would throw some extra money into the campaign and he would get matching funds, it was like a news story. And so everybody's looking at this going, whoa, so that's how the game is played. You know, and I think that helped.
It definitely does. And look, this past week we had a really very, from our point of view as government reform people and campaign reformers, a really upsetting U.S. Supreme Court decision that shows why continually trying to reform and reshape our current dysfunctional campaign finance system is not going to work. We've
well,
got to come up with
here's
an
the problem. I mean, we're talking with Susan Lerner, the executive director of California Clean Money Campaign, CA as in California, CAClean.org, the website, and this Supreme Court decision you're referring to is the one that basically said that a corporation can give unlimited amounts of money to campaign on, quote, an issue, end quote, even if they mention a candidate's name,
right,
even up to the day of the election or the day before the election, doesn't matter. Didn't they just basically hand our entire election process over to multinational, transnational, global corporations or corporations who just don't give a damn even about America? I mean, this could be a Chinese corporation that's spending the money here, number one. And number two, if so, and I think we probably agree that that's the case, what does the California Clean Money Initiative do about that?
Well, see, this is the U.S. Supreme Court carved a huge exception into our current campaign finance system, which is all about restricting, prohibiting, closing down. The California Clean Money Campaign and the idea that we educate people about is the full public funding clean money alternative that opens up the ballot, that invites people to run, that makes it easier for people to run, and allows good people with good ideas to run elections that are about ideas and not money. Look at the headlines about our presidential campaign. Who raised the most money in the quarter that ended in June 30th? Not who's the strongest candidate, who's got the best idea for reforming our broken health care system or dealing with the situation in Iraq, but rather this one raised so many tens of millions versus that one who raised fewer tens of millions, and therefore
well, you notice,
the one with more
Susan,
is better.
You notice who's paying all the attention to who raised how much money is the media, mm-hmm. which is the corporations to whom that money will be given when the time comes to spend it for campaign commercials.
So
it shouldn't surprise us, I suppose.
We need to be paying attention, and we need to be protesting and saying it's not about the money. It's about ideas. We need to give candidates who want to work for us, the people, an alternative where they don't have
so
to
So how do you
us.
Keep corporations from you know, screwing up, and we only have a half a minute here left, I'm sorry, but how do you keep corporations from messing up elections now?
By providing an alternative that matches the money that they try and pour in so that going to the economic stratosphere is no longer effective.
So even if a corporation comes in with so-called issue advertising, you would match that?
That's correct. We would match that, and that's perfectly constitutional. And
sure.
As you pointed out, that shines a light on where their money is coming from and where it's going so that we, the voters, can be informed and make intelligent decisions.
Yeah, it's absolutely marvelous, and I congratulate you on what you're doing there in California, and I hope more people are inspired by it all around the United States to do it. Arizona, it works. Maine, it works. Here in Portland, Oregon, it works. In California, hopefully it will work. California Clean, caclean.org. Susan Lerner, the executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign. Susan, thank you for being with us.
Tom, thank you, and happy Independence Day.
Thank you, and the same to you. Happy 4th of July. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels. I love coffee in a cup, little fuzzy pups, old TV shows, and snow.
And I love America. And it's the 4th of July, a beautiful day. Happy birthday, America, and happy Independence Day. Perhaps that's even more important. 9 minutes before the hour, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on this 4th of July. And we just have about 9 minutes here before we wrap up the show. So, and we've got a whole lot of callers, so let's try and make them short. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Mick in Denver, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Mick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's a great honor to speak to you for the first time here. And a happy 4th to you and the family and all. And the reason I called up was I just wanted to make one comment here. I think we need to do teaching across our public school system here in the nation of history and civics again, like they used to do back in the old days, back in the 40s and the 50s, and all.
And the 60s, really, and the early 60s, 70s. Too. It was the purges, the Reagan-era purges of our public school system.
That's right.
When the David Horowitz types got on their high horse about those unionized teachers in our public school system, they're communists, and they're teaching about the Wobblies and Jim Hill and all. That shouldn't be part of, and they stripped all that stuff out of our history books in the 1980s. So here you've got a generation of kids who went to high school in the late 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s who know absolutely nothing about the history of labor. They don't know about the great sit-down strikes. They don't know about, I mean, they have no connection to the true history of this country, and it's tragic. You're absolutely right, Mick. Thank you very much for calling and making the point. Mike in L.A., California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, people want to get lost in the complications on taxes or monetary systems. In the last 50 years, we've gone from an advanced social contract to a last-man-standing fiefdom protection racket in the private sector. I could sit here and give you hundreds of examples. They talk about redistribution of wealth. 99% of all bills passed by Congress are some redistribution of wealth in some shape or form. So let's put
here's a number for you. 97% of all bills passed by Congress in the last legislative session were initially written by corporations.
Absolutely. You know, they talk about global competition. Well, you know, Chinese labor, foreign labor does not have the carrying cost of American labor. As an example, $1,000 a month rent as most Americans, as an average. You go into Walmart, the cheap products, there's no cheap Charles Schwab, no Blue Cross, no Jacobian Myers, no, you name the legal service or whatever the product is that the essentials for people. Let's talk about electric power. We can't build a power plant in California because it will destroy the profit motive for the oligarchy. So there's no competition. I could sit here all day and expose the lies.
Yep, you and me both, Mike, and spot on. Thank you for saying it. And it's like the German electric system. We should have in California. Every single house should have solar panels on their roof. I mean, it's just really simple. You wouldn't need new power plants. Warren in Eugene, Oregon, and listening on KOPT. Hey, Warren.
Warren. I don't think these corporatists that talk free market and free trade, they don't want free anything. They want to stack the deck more in their favor. If they don't want government regulations, just try taking away their tax breaks and all that favorable legislation that they take advantage of.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right and well said, Warren. John in Santa Monica, California, listening to KLSD. Hey, John.
Good morning, Tom Harton. You've, over time, emphasized and elaborated the importance of the judicious, intentional, and specific language in political discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And I got this idea from an article by John Nichols in The Nation, and in the article he wrote, the label liberal is far less frightening to the electorate than the term neoconservative. And I'd like to suggest that wherever we use Republican or conservative or Republican policies, et cetera, we substitute that for neoconservative.
Yeah, it's a good one. An alternative would be to turn the word Republican into what they turn the word liberal into, which is, you know, a curse word. Jack in San Diego. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, happy Freedom Day, Tom.
Thanks.
I literally thank God for Air America and progressive programming, and your historical perspective is invaluable. Thomas Jefferson said, it's not the destiny of mankind for a wealthy few to ride booted and spurred upon the backs of the majority. Today, because of the radio and the internet, I think we're seeing really a tornado of truth exposing this fascist elite. They go on TV, wealthy, educated, they reassure people, hey, nothing's happening here, go back to your baseball game, we'll investigate ourselves. But because everything has gotten so bad, a big majority of the people see there's a huge problem. And I think this is really a historic opportunity for a thorough push to eradicate the evil. And I personally believe your focus on illegitimate corporate personhood is targeting a central fact in the whole big mess.
Well, thank you, Jack. I do believe that's a linchpin to the whole thing, too. I agree. Evan in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Evan, about a half a minute before we got to wrap up the show.
All right. I think that if a little off topic, but I think that if Congress had given Bush anything other than what he wanted as far as the the funding for the troops and the funding for the occupation, that he could have possibly invoked this NSPD 51. That was not published until like May 9th, right in the middle of the all of the controversy, the debate on the war funding. One of the definitions of catastrophic emergency is a disruption that severely affects government function.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That's interesting, the timeline of that. It's just like the timeline in the Scooter Libby trial. Scooter Libby's lawyer says he's going to call Dick Cheney as a witness, and then all of a sudden, Scooter Libby rolls over, and there's no more defense being given. And now, he's getting a commutation. Hey, tomorrow, Thursday, on the Tom Hartman program, I'll be confronting conservative Devin Harricks on his article about Michael Moore. Andrew Goss is here to talk about eliminating pennies. Sarah Vandergelder about Cuba's national health mission. And Christy Harvey on the News Below the Radar. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Happy 4th of July. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.